all I heard was that my fertility was impacted and the rest of it was white noise. I had a thing called Sertoli-only cell syndrome. If sperm production is an assembly line and there's three guys on the assembly line, only one of them showed up for work today for me. Really treated this as a me problem instead of an us problem. I treated it as if you don't have any problems. You could have a kid next year, whereas I'm left with this.
Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today we are joined by a member of the Nexus Fertility community, and that is Scott Noland. Hello, buddy. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad now. Slightly nervous, but yeah, we're all right.
That's all good. Thank you for joining us, mate. It's a privilege to have you here.
You were our first guest from Ireland. You know, we've ticked off England, obviously, Scotland, Wales, and now we've got Ireland as well. So it's an absolute privilege to have you on, mate. And we're really looking forward to this discussion. We're trying to build, obviously, awareness that there's more to life than fertility. Obviously, when you're going through it, it consumes yourself, like, completely. That's all you can think about the majority of the time. It's hard to break away from that. But what we're really keen to know before we dive into your story is, you know, a bit more about Scott. You know, what do you do? What do you like to do? What do you like to do to relax? Those type of things. So let's start with, what was it like growing up in Ireland?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a small kind of a coastal city. And like anyone in Ireland, I kind of had a kind of an ideal childhood back in the good times before like 2008 when the global crash came. But yeah, no, it was funny. I lived in a place called Hillview. It was before kind of urban sprawl happened, where there was countryside 2 minutes away from the house, like fields and rolling fields as far as the eye could see. So I was known to get lost out there for hours on end. A couple of times had the cops called to look for us during the summer months. But yeah, no, growing up was kind of a, I'm not going to say an idyllic childhood because I don't want to be a liar on the airwaves. But yeah, no, it was a childhood like anyone else's. I spent most of it outside, not buried to a screen, which was great, like, you know. But yeah, growing up, I suppose I was about 14 or 15 kind of when I started branching out from where I lived and hanging around in different parts of the city and stuff like that and different kind of groups, and ended up like really kind of loving the seaside aspect of it. And I live by the seaside now. So yeah, it was a pretty, again, don't want to be a liar, but it was an idyllic enough childhood until, yeah, like I said, 2008 came along and the arse absolutely fell out of the economy. Like my parents, my stepfather's he was a construction by trade, and he was a scaffolder by trade, he had his own business. And when that came, it just completely kind of decimated everything. And I suppose overnight, the world kind of as we knew it changed. And my prospects of things kind of changed as well, because I was just at the time of finishing school when all that happened, like, you know.
Yeah, definitely, man. Growing up, I felt life was a lot freer. You know, you've mentioned screen times and things like that now. Like, it's not like it was, you know, just going out and coming in when the lights went off, you know, and the street lights came on. It was like, oh, it's time to go in for dinner, you know. And
yeah, or being, like, there was no phones. There was no phone call to say get in. It was just that one person in the group who had a watch told everyone what time it was, and the panic set in and fellas ran for the hills. And it was idyllic, you know. It was just like, nowadays kids have to contend with so much fucking shit, I suppose, you know, just having to keep up with what's on the internet and stuff like that. There was none of that back in the day. I think I had the same pair of runners for about 6 years. My nieces, and they change it more than I change my underpants, you know.
Cycle to your mate's house just to see if they're in. They live like 4 miles away. You get there, yeah. They're not in. You have to cycle home.
Simpler times. A beautiful time as well, but a great childhood. And that would have formed who you were as a young adult. And before you, what happened that has led you to be here, like that diagnosis, who were you as a young adult and kind of going into the formative years of your life? Who were you? What were you doing? Did you have it all figured out?
Oh, God. No, not at all. I still don't.
No, who does, say?
I think if anyone tells you to do it, they're a liar.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I suppose I finished school when I was 19. And I was kind of, so I suppose I was like most kids, like most people my age coming out into the grown-up world at that time, I was kind of rudderless. And like you couldn't get a job in construction. So even if I wanted a trade, it wasn't happening. And to be perfectly honest, I was a terrible student in school. Like I'm not unintelligent. I was just an asshole and I just thought I knew better than teachers, you know? And like much to my detriment in later life. But yeah, kind of, I came out of school in 2009 and I kind of bounced around then. I played rugby in Limerick, which is another county in Ireland that would be kind of big on the rugby scene. I played rugby up there for a while. And that didn't exactly go to plan. I think I thought I was going to be a professional rugby player, naively enough. I joined the Irish Army then in 2012 after working a couple of odd jobs. I was there for 5 years, was it? Yeah, just about 5 years. Done a tour of Syria, kind of bounced around within the Army doing different courses and stuff like that. Again, I was in my early 20s. Before I was in the Army, I was like anyone else. I was like any other teenager, teenage male, I should say, bouncing around and bed hopping and doing what teenage boys do with the fear of, if you looked at a one, see, in school, we were told, like, if you looked at a one wrong, you could get her pregnant.
Mm.
And it was only later on, so in the last like 2 years, I've realized that I have more chance of making something go to space than I have to of getting a girl pregnant by looking at her. The early years, I suppose, were just a mixture of being a teenager, too much drinking, too much skirt chasing, and too much just acting the asshole, you know. And then joined the Army about when I was 21, and that kind of set me on the straight and narrow. I went my now wife for the last 13 years. So like the day after I turned 21, I met my wife. Been with her ever since, but yeah, the early years where I never even thought about kids in a way that I knew I wanted them, but I never thought about them in a way that I could have one here. You know, if I do something wrong here, do you know, it never kind of popped into my mind. Like that was me until I was about 26. I did one tour of Syria. I left the Army then and I served my time as an electrician, funnily enough. I went from not being able to get a trade to multiple jobs as a tradesman. And yeah, that was it up until I was 30. And then COVID hit at the end of my trade. So I was kind of stalled a small bit. I finished my trade eventually and I became what's called a commissioning engineer. So I traveled all over Ireland and Europe. You just sign off on jobs, pharma and data, all that kind of stuff. It's fairly boring, but it keeps the wolf in the door. So
you've been busy.
It's a lot, man. It's a lot. If you ask my wife, I'm always sitting down.
When you actually sit back and talk it through, you think, I've done a lot in the last 10 years. Like it really happens quick. Going back to when you were down in the beers and having a good time, was there any kind of thought of how that could affect your fertility for the future? Like were you educated on that at all as a youngster?
No, and I should say that like the Irish school system, I'm out of school so long now, I don't know if it's changed, but like there's no health class in that way. There's no male fertility, and I'll get into that later, of like the network of say support and education for men and young men even to kind of have a path of even investigating this kind of thing, you know. And like I can't speak for women. I don't know if it's the same. I'm sure they're told about certain things. Like my wife is an encyclopedia for female fertility. So like I'm sure that there are certain ways, but for men and young boys and teenagers and stuff like that, no, God no, there was nothing. Like we were just basically, there was kind of that old Catholic guilt of you can't even look at a woman now, you'll get her pregnant. You know, it was kind of what would you say? It was kind of a scaremongering thing. Like, they never explained to you how you'd get her pregnant, really. But if you looked at her, you could get her pregnant. Or maybe they didn't, I just wasn't listening. But, like, yeah, this is throughout the school. Now there's nothing in terms of, what would you say, I suppose sexual health, in a way. There's nothing really, like, you know? Like, you kind of, and I suppose that back when I was in school, I suppose if you asked, you kind of, you nearly feel ostracized in a way. You know, someone would look at you, or the teacher would kind of be, how do you know about that? Or, you know, stuff like that.
Was there quite a lot of emphasis in society from a religious standpoint then?
I suppose if you speak to someone else from Ireland, they're going to have a different, everyone's going to have a different opinion on it. But I think there's a lot of kind of, especially when I was in school, you know, I had teachers who were teachers in the early 90s up until, so even in the late 80s, we'd say. And like, that's when kind of, there wouldn't have been an emphasis on religion, but it still would have been a big part of society and a big part of the culture. It's maybe it's only dying off now with people of my generation becoming teachers and stuff like that. But yeah, you could definitely, it wasn't rammed down our throats or anything like that. And I don't mean to say that it was, but it definitely was an influence, in whether it was acknowledged or whether it was just a passive influence that it had always been there, so it will always be there type thing. I don't know, but yeah, there is definitely an influence of some form of religion, I suppose, you know, some sort of belief system in it.
Kind of segueing away from religious belief, but another belief that you have mentioned that we all kind of grew up with, certainly kids from our era, that your fertility is a guarantee, that, like you said, if you even look at a woman, there's a chance of knocking her up. So take us to the point where that suddenly isn't becoming the case. How, like, your missus and you start trying to conceive, like, what happens then?
I have a different journey to where we figured this out. And in a way, and I don't want this to sound in any way kind of crass or anything, but in a way I'm kind of lucky the way I found out, and I acknowledge that. But yeah, so how I came to figure this out was 2 or 3 years ago. I noticed that I was kind of piling on weight, and that just wasn't me. Like I said, when I was younger, I was constantly outside. I won't sit still. I was sports, mad, always doing something, you know. And I noticed that I was piling on weight, and I couldn't get out of bed. And for a guy that was in the army, who was literally woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning with a wet mop to the face at one point or another, to not being able to get out of bed, I just figured something was wrong, you know. And I made it a point to get a set of bloods I had done with my local GP. And when I got them, when I was getting it, this is actually a vivid memory, when I was getting it done, I had asked the nurse that was doing it, could you mark the testosterone panel? And she, I can't do that, the doctor didn't order. And I kind of said, I was like, look, I forgot to ask him, can you please mark it? No, I can't do that. I kind of had to fight kind of tooth and nail to get her to do it. Like, I'm the patient here. I'm concerned about something to do with me, like, you know. But eventually she relented, and she did them for me. And I think it was 4 or 5 days later, my GP himself rang me. And he just said, Scott, what made you ask for testosterone drugs? And what's funny is, it was something on YouTube. You know, these ads that pop up before you watch a video, and it's some absolutely huge fellow with a six pack saying, do you feel like you have a low mood? It could be your testosterone. I bought this hook, line, and sinker. I said, oh, he's looking at me right now. He's disturbing me to a T. So he rings me up and he said, what made you ask for that? Now, I didn't give him that description. I just said, oh, as if I pulled the knowledge from my own head. I said, just didn't feel right. And I just thought, like, I'd kind of seen the testosterone was linked to low mood and kind of weight gain and stuff. And he just said, well, look, he said, fair play to you that you copped it yourself, because he was like, your testosterone's basically in the toilet. Like, it's not in the medical sense that he say it, but he was just like, you need to come back in and we need to discuss this. So I went back in maybe a day or two later, and I think the levels are, everywhere measures them so differently. I think the levels for a man my age are between like 8 and 24, which is a massive scope of difference in anyone's terms, but mine were like 4.1. I basically had no testosterone whatsoever. And now that's not to say that that was the cause of, that was the cause of everything that I was feeling. It kind of shone a light on how I'd been feeling, we'd say, over the past year, year and a bit, that I was kind of, wow, okay, so this is it. So I just thought, again, harrowing back to the guy on the YouTube ad, thinking, I'm just going to get testosterone here. I'm going to be fucking ripped and jacked and all this stuff, not knowing anything about the fertility side of things and what this meant at that time. So he sends me to an endocrinologist in Cork, which is a county. He sends me to her and she basically says, yeah, look, we have to do a battery of tests. We have to do such and such. She mentioned Klinefelter's. She mentioned a couple of things. And it was at the end of that appointment, she mentioned, I'm not saying it is, but she said your fertility can be affected by how low your testosterone is. And it was only then, now, I mean to say, driving up in the car, I thought I was coming out of there with 6 months worth of testosterone and I was going to be the rock in 6 months time. Whereas when I left there, the only thing I had in my head where she spoke to me for an extra 20 minutes about fertility, but all I heard was that my fertility was impacted and the rest of it was white noise kind of after that. And she suggested that I go get a sperm analysis done. So again, I kind of went home in the car the whole way and all I had in my head was fertility, because to get my wife in here or anyone that really knows me, they tell you like, I'm incredibly good with kids and I've always wanted kids. Like if I had have had a kid when I was 19, just by looking at a girl, it wouldn't have bothered me. You know, I'm kind of that way inclined. So yeah, she recommended I get a sperm analysis done and I got it done in a clinic here in town. They're called Waterstones. They're a fertility specialist clinic. So, and by the way, I want to preface this, I paid for this entirely out of pocket. This entire journey that I've gone on, I've paid for it entirely myself. So I went and I done the sperm analysis and I live about 20 minutes away from the town. So I think it was about 5 minutes from home. My phone rings. That's a number I don't recognize. So I answered, hello, yeah. And they give me this news where, yeah, we looked at your sample. There is nothing there. And I was like, nothing, not one sperm, nothing. And she was like, no, there's nothing there. She goes, now look, it could be a missed sample. But she was like, there's nothing there if you want to arrange another one. And in the interim of this, now these are about €110. A pop. So what's that? It's about £100, we'd say a pop. Not a massive amount of money, but also not an insignificant amount. And so I arranged to do one like 4 days later. No one told me that it was 3 months between samples. No one, now this is the same clinic twice and no one bothered to mention that. Like 3 months is kind of the waiting period, we'll say. So 4 days later, I go back, I do another one. Nothing again. I'm absolutely shattered. So these results go to the endocrinologist that I see in Cork, and she refers me to a urologist who has a 7 month wait I had. And again, privately, out of my own pocket, which I'm blessed to have a job where I can afford to kind of do these things privately and I can't because I know that there's so many that can't. But I go and see this guy. Can I mention his name?
Yeah.
So his name is Dr. Ivor Cullen. Incredible guy. Really, really good. But I go and see him and he's incredibly straight talking. So the first appointment I had with him, I go with my wife. I kind of left feeling as if I'd gotten a hiding off him. Just a verbal beating of sorts because he was just so straight about it. He said, you have this, the chances of you having children are incredibly, incredibly small. This is what we're going to do. So he put me on a tablet, which I've seen a couple of guys in the group on, and I wrote in about my experiences. It was Clomid or Clomiphene, I believe some of it's called, but he put me on this and no word of a lie, what proceeded over the next 4 months that I was on that was quite possibly the barring the failed microtease, it was quite possibly the worst 4 months of my life. It drove me into a huge, massive depression. There was so much so that I genuinely didn't think I'd come out of it. The 4 months of that were in an effort to kind of boost my natural production of testosterone, therefore hopefully leading on to some production of a sperm cell in advance of a microtease. So this is all over the course of maybe 18 months. And in that time I got married, which without a doubt the best day in my life, but was also in the middle of a period where I genuinely didn't even know who I was. I completely lost who I was mentally. But yeah, so it went down from there. And I should say this as well, that my wife was absolutely incredible through this entire time, which I didn't give her enough credit for. So yeah, we do a microtease. That was March just gone. We did a microtease, and again, Dr. Ivor Cullen did the microtease, but the sample that he takes gets sent to this lab. That was on a Friday, and I was obviously at home with a jockstrap on and my feet up for the next 2 weeks, and I get a phone call on the Monday. Now, this phone call lasted all of a minute and a half to be told that your microtease didn't work. There's nothing else. This is from the clinic now. This is not from Dr. Cullen. So your microtease didn't work. Sorry about that. And that was it.
Wow.
This is who we can refer you to speak with. There was no, is there something else we can answer for you? There was nothing in terms of a follow-up. It was just, I'm very sorry to tell you, but there was nothing found in your sample. Silence. And I just had to kind of accept it. My wife was off work at the time. She kind of got emotional about it, whereas I didn't. Like from that second on, I just kind of bottled up. But yeah, so the failed microtease was then, I think, 6 weeks after the operation, I was brought back up to Dr. Cullen, who basically said, look, I'm incredibly sorry. There's nothing else I can do for you. If you ever need anything, I'm here to talk to you. But he said, I had no answer. And I'm the type of person where I, if something's wrong, there has to be a reason for it and there has to be an answer for it. And the only answer I was given was, I had a thing called Sertoli-only cell syndrome. And how it was described to me was, if sperm production is an assembly line and there's three guys on the assembly line, only one of them is present. Only one of them showed up for work today for me. And that was pretty much it. And then what happened after that then was, I'm sure we'll get into it, but that was a 2-year journey. And it was, again, out of my own pocket. Again, I'm lucky enough to be able to afford it, but it still is a massive cost to incur, especially for a country who prides itself on being so advanced with healthcare and stuff like that. And it is in certain aspects, don't get me wrong, we're incredibly privileged to live where we live compared to other countries, but in terms of fertility and things like that, it seems to be kind of a redheaded stepchild issue.
So were you signposted to for any support when you got that phone call?
Not a thing. When the support originally came was when we started looking at IVF. So I should have said all that time about, like, myself and my wife weren't trying. It just all came about from me not feeling right. And then just journey of discovery happened for both of us, because like my wife is completely healthy fertility wise. We're lucky and fortunate enough that she has like good ovarian reserves and a number of eggs, all that kind of stuff. We're incredibly fortunate that way. But the only time we were kind of signposted towards for lack of a better term, a mental health talk was when we decided we were going to do the IVF and you have to speak to a counselor to make sure that you qualify for it. But again, that's an hour of a talk once, and they sign a letter for the fertility clinic to say, yeah, they're good to go. You know, on a personal level, I wasn't signposted anywhere. It was actually my wife that found Nexi's, which I'm eternally grateful for as well. a credit to go to what you've accomplished there. But no, it was through the wonder of social media that I found an actual outlet for myself.
Thank you, buddy. Thanks for those kind words in terms of saying that we've helped you. You know, that's why we do this, you know, and it really means a lot. Really does. This series is all about reminding you that when it comes to fertility, you're not on your own. At the Male Fertility Podcast, we know how powerful the right support can be, which is why we've partnered with Fertility Family to share Imperial. We all know that nutrition matters when it comes to fertility, but let's be honest, maintaining a perfectly balanced diet for conception is incredibly hard. Choosing a supplement can be just as confusing, especially when many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants that can actually harm sperm quality. Imperil is different. It's made from activated micronutrients that support every cell in the body, from the largest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These nutrients have been clinically shown to significantly improve live birth rates in men and women who have previously been struggling to conceive. Imperil is different. It's made using activated micronutrients that support every cell in the body, from the largest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These nutrients have been clinically shown to significantly improve live birth rates in men and women who have previously struggled to conceive. What we like is that behind the science at Fertility Family are real stories from real people. To find out more, visit www.fertilityfamily.co.uk. And if you decide it's right for you, our listeners get 10% off using the code MFPOD10. That's MFPOD10. Now, back to the episode. There's so many questions I've got. Like, all the way back, was it the nurse or the doctor said to you that there, you know, there's a chance that your fertility could be affected? And that white noise, I think that's so common with men. As soon as something's dropped in, possibly about fertility, you don't remember what I said after that. And I distinctly remember that. Like, I used to come out of consultations and be like, what did they say? Because I'd get to a certain point and I couldn't take in anymore. And it was usually when there was another bit of bad news. You know, they had another semen analysis and that comes back and it's worse than the last one. Or, you know, it's the same again. Or you now got to go and have this test. You just go, oh, fuck, I've got, there's more. And you just kind of end up blanking everything out. So that white noise is so common. I'm sure there's loads of guys listening to this thinking, I've experienced that. So it's really important, I feel, that we need to highlight that that's really common. I actually ended up taking Jen into the majority of my appointments just because I just couldn't recall it. You just get to the point that it was too much and I just kind of shut down, you know. But then there's like I've got loads of questions about the funding. Like,
please, if I can answer.
And then we'll get back to the support. I just want to kind of touch on it while we can. So is any of it funded or is it all private?
So in Ireland, there's a certain criteria you have to meet to be able to avail of IVF funding. There is, I don't know what the NHS does, but you get one cycle of funding. So you get one cycle of IVF through the HSE year. Basically, I suppose the government kind of did it to, I don't know. I can't speak to their motivations of it, but to me, it seems like the government did it to be seen to be doing something, if you know what I mean. For such a prevalent issue, they came out and gave the minimum that they could give while keeping it like donor conception is not covered. So that kind of pigeonholes the likes of me, especially with male fertility becoming such an issue. Like my urologist had said to me that one in three patients he sees now are male fertility issues, you know, and like he reckons that the level of infertility in terms of statistic, we'll say, is 60-40 in terms of male-female, 60% female issue, 40% male, and he reckons it could surpass that like in years to come. But that's getting off topic. But the funding, there's nothing in terms of even the exploratory side of it before the IVF. For me, like the microtesa, no, there's nothing. And that operation costs, they've got to €12,000 here. Like, before you even attempt to get a straw for donation or attempt an IVF cycle or anything like that. There's absolutely nothing. Every consultation you go to is €250, which is about £200. I'm sure the costs are similar in the UK, but it's still not covered. And no health insurance covers a microtesia either. So it is out of pocket if that's the avenue you want to go down, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, it's incredible. That will just mount up, won't it? You know, that's an incredible lot of money. And as you said, you're privileged to be in that point where you could fund it, but there'd be so many people out there that just aren't. In the UK, in terms of what cycles you get, it's like a postcode lottery. So different places have different rules. When we were in Sussex, it was one. You could get one cycle. So we purposely upshifted and moved to Bedford where we could get three. But then when we got to Bedfordshire, we had to wait for a year to be there before we qualified for three cycles. But people are literally uprooting and moving for these things when they can. Yeah, it's really tough. It's really tough out in Ireland. It's one of those topics that I think it's important we talk about. Like, it's the acknowledgement of it. And as you said, in terms of the development awareness of male infertility, like, it makes sense that this statistically is correct in terms of it's half the problem, but it makes sense that it is. Like, there's two people involved and it's going to be half the problem. Like, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. But I think we are maybe across the Western world slowly waking up to the fact of more needs to be done, especially helping people. If it's a growing issue, we need to be looking at this and supporting people appropriately, you know, getting into the bigger picture. If the human race isn't, you know, populating the earth in terms of having children, and it's only going to end one way, isn't it? In the years and years and years to come. But we have to be aware of that now. But yeah, sounds tough, man. Sounds tough.
I know personally people that have gone to Eastern Europe to do IVF because the cycle over there might be, I don't know, maybe €2,000 as opposed to maybe 7 or 8 here. Within my family, like, there's two kids that were born through IVF in Eastern Europe. Perfectly healthy, both of them absolute lunatics, but perfectly healthy, and it costs an absolute fraction of what it would have cost here. And what's funny about that is those two kids are the first children I ever knew of that were born through IVF, because it was such a, for lack of a better term, it was such a dirty word. You know, and people were so private about it and stuff like that. Whereas part of me wonders where if people had been open about it back however many years ago, would there be a more advanced system in place now for the likes of me who have to deal with it? And God forbid, if I had kids and they had to deal with the same issue, do you know what I mean?
It is worrying, isn't it? And you can only hope with more awareness being raised and voices getting stronger as, like, together, that changes are being made, hopefully, and the future is a bit easier for those behind us to navigate, because we found ourselves in this all quite blind, really, haven't we? And, like, you know, that point where you've given the very final news about the microtesia not yielding any results, and just not even being signposted for support, just having a phone call, which is like a minute and a half long, for want of a better phrase, bedside care needs to drastically improve as well. Where were you left after that, like, mentally?
Honestly, I was destroyed. Like, I mean, I was a shell of myself. Anyone in that group has experienced it, I suppose, just this absolute stripping of any form of masculinity I thought I had was just completely taken. Like, my masculinity was just completely taken from me. And mentally, I took, like, for lack of a better way, I took it from myself in a way, because I wasn't made aware of any supports. I was just given this information, and being a man, you process bad news like a man does, and you immediately turn the blame inward. Do you know, I had all these questions, like, did I do something wrong? What happened here? Was it because of this? Was it because of that? Or was it because when I was younger, I just acted the maggot? And, you know, like, I was just left with a million and one questions, and every single bad thought in my head just echoed for months on end. Like, to be honest with you, it's it's only over, say, the last maybe 2 or 3 months that I've really kind of come out the kind of other side of it. And don't get me wrong, you still get days when they are like, I text into the group there a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine was talking about IVF and they just literally had an egg retrieval and they had done ICSI. So they're waiting their 2 weeks now to deliver it. And I was kind of left again. I suppose I was kind of angry or jealous in a way, but like for the last number of months after the surgery, I was just destroyed. I couldn't be happy. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And it wasn't just that I couldn't be happy in a situation. I couldn't be happy for anyone. Do you know, Instagram when people are having kids, I was just really, I wasn't nasty, but I was just like pissed off at everyone. And yeah. Annoyed that it was so easy for some people.
And it's all around you, isn't it?
It's inescapable, like, you know.
Yeah. And
to be honest, a lot of credit goes to my wife here. She's been amazing through this whole thing, but I really treated this as a me problem instead of an us problem. And that has been like to the detriment of my marriage in a way. I treated it as if, well, you don't have any problems. I'm the problem here. If you would decide to fuck off in the morning, you could have a kid next year. Whereas I'm left with this. You know, I never really acknowledged how much it affected her and us as a unit. I can't have kids. I'm a problem here. I have zero way to conceive. This is all me. This is not an us problem. This is a me problem. And like that was my mentality for months and months after it. And it drove me into just this complete spiral.
Where are you at with that now?
Honestly, if I felt as in any way that I wasn't 100% kind of at peace with the fact that we have to do donor conception, I wouldn't be sitting here in front of you. I mean this genuinely, hand on my heart. It's because of Nexi's that I am where I am now. And especially from you, Sean, we had done a talk a couple of months ago. You said something about, is it your wife's niece and how much of a good relationship you have with her?
Yeah.
For some reason, that hit me like a bolt of lightning. I'm so good with like all my friends' kids and like my nieces. I'm unbelievably good with all them, or any kid I meet, I kind of just, it sounds weird, but I kind of just gel with kids. Do you know, I'm really like, I'm really paternal in a way. I'm 6'3" and I'm 16 and a half stone. I'm not someone that should be on a bouncy castle at a child's birthday party, but I will be the guy throwing kids around a bouncy castle. It was when you said that, I kind of realized, it kind of came back to me a small bit that like, I should have said this from the start, but I'm a stepfather. I don't know my biological father.
Well, so, I was going to come back to that because yeah. You did say about it at the beginning, and you said, when you talk about your childhood, you said my mum and dad. Then you corrected yourself and said, oh no, my stepfather. I picked up on that. And I was going to, expand on that, because your initial and gut reaction was to
say father.
Say my father, yeah.
It always is. And I call him my dad to anyone who speaks. I'll call him my father or whatever.
And
if I sit back and look at who I am as a person, I have a lot of traits from him. Do you know? I have I have a work ethic from him. I have a love of reading, that kind of thing. Just, you know, small stuff that you impart on someone, yeah. Not that is given to you genetically. I have a lot of that from him. And that's something that I really forgot when I got the news of a microtisa. It's something that was completely blocked out by all the negative thoughts that I had.
Yeah.
I could never allow the fact that essentially I am a donor conceived child.
Yeah.
My older brother would joke and say that my biological father, he calls him a sperm donor. Which, like, you know, like, essentially I am. And it's just something that I totally ignored, again, given that it was a me problem, you know?
Yeah.
I just completely ignored the fact that I am a stepfather who I share no genetic makeup with, but I share a lot of similarities with. And what's funny is when I was in college, my college phase for being an electrician, one of the lads, my parents live around the corner from the college. And one of the lads was in the car one day, and I went up to my mom and dad's house. And my father came out to give me something. He's sitting in the car beside me, and my dad kind of came up to the window and he goes, "Oh, here, this was up in the house. This is belonged to you." "Yeah, no problem." Took it off and headed back to college. And the guy was sitting beside me went, "Jesus, you're the head of your father." And I just started laughing. My stepfather is about 5'8" and he's as wide as he is tall. And I look absolutely nothing like him. But I turned around and I was kind of looking at him. I was like, "What? Is it your Jesus, you're the fucking head of him." And I just started laughing. He goes, "What are you laughing at?" I was like, "He's not my dad. He's my stepfather. He's just been here since I was like 5. And he was like, "Oh my God, how do you look like someone you're in no way related to?" And I couldn't get over. And I told him, when I told my father, the only thing he said was, "Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry." That's the only thing he said, you know? And yeah, it was just something that I had completely just put on the back shelf in terms of my thinking and my approach to the whole situation for the last number of months.
That's trauma, that's stress, that's grief. It blocks the rational state of mind. And often those answers are a lot closer than we realize. Like, it literally is closer to the man who raised you. And then, like you mentioned, what I said about my niece, that you're seeing those examples all around you. And it was always there. But when you have life-changing news, and you're in that swirling state of it, and that guilt, the shame, the self-blame, all of that's going on, suddenly those things that are that close are lost. And it just takes that one little spark. And that's the beauty of community and other men talking about their experiences, because it can be that one little nugget that you go, "Oh shit, of course, like that's it." And like, I get it all the time with my son. Like, people say to me, people that know our story as well, "Oh my God, he looks so much like you." And it's nature versus nurture. It's a big argument to have. We could do a whole series on it. But ultimately, when you are raised by someone who's having that much of an input and impression on you, you're going to be like them in ways that aren't inherited but via biology. It's that molding a child, an impressionable child, and hopefully to become a good human being. But and that's the beauty of parenthood, is that you can try your best to impart the best bits and try and eliminate the bits that we've inherited from our parents that might not have been the best bits. And that it completely is not reliant on any biological link.
You're 100%. And what's funny is, again, I didn't find the Nexi community. My wife found them for me at a time, to be honest, when she probably just should have hated me and said, "Fuck him," you know, because of the way I was acting. But when she found it, she showed me your page, and she showed me, I think there's a picture of, maybe is it you and your son? They're twins, that's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, boy and girl.
And she
said,
"Look at that. Don't they look like each other?" And I was like, "Yes, yeah, they do. Yeah, white." She's like, "Well, he's a donor, can see child." Like, you know, it's, and I was kind of sitting there and I was like, fuck. You know, I think there's kind of a misconception of, in the kind of broader world, I suppose, of a donor conceived child. It's like an Argos catalog that you're just handing this book and you pick something. Like, with the genetic testing that goes into it to get someone that's so closely matched to you genetically and your physical attributes in a way that, like, they genuinely are, like, donor conceived kids are 90% of the time, or 99% of the time, are probably genetically almost identical to the person that they're being raised by. There's the advances in modern medicine that should be heralded. It's incredible. Like, again, I look nothing like my stepfather, but according to one fellow who probably didn't have glasses on at the time, I'm a spitting image of him. It is incredible to see how advanced it really is that a complete stranger on the internet, be at the time being you, Sean, my wife showed me a picture of you and your kids, and never in a million years would I have ever said that they were donor conceived kids, do you know?
Yeah, Thanks, mate. I'm glad she found me and us. And it often is the female partner who does and then politely elbows the fella our way.
Yeah. Well, unless you started putting up videos of carpentry and cooking steak, I was never going to find you. So, and I'm bad at both of those things.
Buddy, I think it's amazing how far you've come in such a short amount of time. And listening to you there, I really do feel unconsciously it's been that relationship with your dad, as you call him, because he is your dad. I think the brain is an amazing way of processing things, even when we're not conscious of it. And it just took Sean a little comment about something and you linked all the dots. And it's, yeah, man, it's amazing that one, Sean's been so helpful for you because that's what he does it for. But also you've been managed to do it, you know, because it must be an incredibly tough road to walk. I don't have donor conceived children, so I didn't have to go down that route. But talking to Sean and so many other guys that have, I know how tough it can be. So, and hats off to you. You're doing an amazing job. And, you know, it's a privilege to have you in the community and such a valuable part of it as well. It's been incredible having you in there, mate.
I appreciate it.
Oh, no, I really mean it. I really, really do mean it. Like, you're active, you chat, you know, you help out, you ask the questions, you know, that's what it's about. That community is being there for others, being there when you need them, but then you're there for other people as well. And it feels like a small little brotherhood, doesn't it? We're all there for each other and that's what it's about.
Oh, definitely.
You have good days, you have bad days. You said that in terms of like, you've come to terms with things, you've accepted things, but there's still bad days. And me and Sean have talked about this, that even as far down the road as we are, there's still things that trip us both up and we go, phew, didn't expect that. Conversations we have with people and can bring up those raw emotions, but the community is there for all of us, isn't it? And it's a fantastic place to be. Cheers, buddy. Really appreciate it, man.
Look, it's a credit to both you. Even on days when I'm having a bad day, and you know, it's this thing of being open and vulnerable. That like sometimes you still don't want to write into a group. You still don't want to be that vulnerable in front of however many guys are in the group now. But when someone writes in, and it could be totally unrelated, and you see the responses, you just know that even if you don't write in, you know that there's someone there that if you do decide you're getting to the point where you need to write in, you're going to get 101 responses and you're going to realize you're not alone.
I think it might have even been you who joined on a Sunday and put the first message in about 8:30 in the morning, got loads of responses, and then about 1:30 in the afternoon, like literally 5 hours later, said, for the first time in years, I don't feel like a pariah. Was that you?
Yeah, I just remembered that.
And I've quoted that a few times recently when I've been talking about the community, and it's just twigged to me that was you. Yeah. That is powerful. In 5 hours, you've gone from joining, writing out what you've been through, which, you know, not everyone does, which is fine as well. Some people join, sit in the background and watch what happens and get that support that way. But you put yourself out there, you explain where you are, and the guys that jumped on and were responding. And then for you to go from where you were to where you were five hours later to feel like that, just to feel so accepted. And that word, that stuck with me. And like I said, I've mentioned that a few times because that is the beauty of the community, I would say, to take you from that place of complete isolation to a place of community and feeling validated. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming in and sharing. And then I'm pleased that you had that response of guys wrapping around you.
The only thing you said wrong there was I actually joined on a Saturday night. And my wife, did you write in yet? Did you write in yet? Did you write in yet? And I was just there, no, I haven't wrote in. I don't know what to say. And I honestly had written a message and deleted it countless times before I actually sent it. And I do remember sitting there, and you're right, it was on a Sunday morning. I sent it in. And the second I sent it, I just felt this kind of, just this kind of relief, for lack of a better term, just that it's out there now, because I hadn't told anyone, and I still kind of have it in a way. A couple of my really close friends know, but again, they don't know the extent of it. I'm quite guarded in what I will say, and what I choose to share. And that's, and I've realized over the last while that that's okay as well. You know, you don't have, I don't have to be an open book at all times to all people, which is something I kind of would have not always been, but I would have been a kind of an oversharer. But this has kind of really helped me realize that, like, no, what I want to keep hidden and what I want to keep to myself is perfectly fine, you know? And yeah, my wife she's absolutely incredible in terms of this whole thing. And I genuinely don't give her enough credit for it. But yeah, Saturday night, Sunday morning. And I think, yeah, by lunchtime, it was either you or Henry maybe was the first to respond. And then my wife, what did they say? And I was sitting there, I was like, you don't need to know what they said. This is a men's group. This is for men. You're not involved in this, you know.
You have to be careful how much credit you give the wives, because they start to use it as leverage for other things.
She can use it for whatever she wants. She gets all the credit here.
Yeah, mate. I think we're all in agreement here. Like, our wives have been incredible pillars in our lives, and we definitely wouldn't be the men we are without them. You know, they're our better halves, as we often say. So what does the future look like for you? What's the next few months hold for Scott?
To kind of go forward, after the bug teaser, again, I said I ended up in a kind of a dark spot, and just, I wasn't bad or anything, but you know, I was completely closed off. Like zero communication in terms of how I felt or how I was being affected by this. So much so that, like, my wife would be like, how do you feel about it? Yeah, no, I'm fine, yeah. It is what it is, like, was my big saying for the months of all this. And, like, just that complete breakdown in communication. We're only married a year and it nearly tore us apart. Now, again, we still have work to do on that, you know. I still get days where I don't want to talk. But I know that opening up and actually being vulnerable about the whole thing and saying that I'm not okay is perfectly okay. So yeah, over the next couple of months, depending on my wife, we have to, not exactly up to speed on what the IVF trail looks like, so I would assume, but there's bloods and there's all this kind of stuff. And then we have to, I think the way it's done here is you do genetic bloods, and my wife has to do obviously all these ovarian reserve tests, all this kind of stuff. And then you're given, I keep on calling it the Hourglass catalog of donors. I suppose you pick from there, and then again, you get your straws. I think the company we intend on using, they recommend 3 to 4 straws from your chosen donor if that's what you're going for. And then you go through that whole cycle. So we're probably a small bit off that now. Maybe, again, it's close to the end of the year now, so I don't want to be starting anything now. But I'd say maybe towards the middle of next year, we'll probably kind of start the whole process again. With how I acted over the last couple of months, I'd rather take that time and make sure that we're 100% rather than jumping the gun. And just, you know, these tiny little cracks still being there, and the cracks turn to fissures, and it just ends up a thing again. Do you know, I just rather focus on my marriage for the time being. And then when the IVF talk comes up again, go with it that way. But I don't want to jump the gun at anything.
That makes perfect sense, buddy. You know, yeah, things have been rocky for you. And I completely understand that, wanting to ground yourself before you move on to the next stage. And obviously, the best of luck to everything that happens, and take your time, keep processing. You're doing an amazing job, mate, and that's absolutely incredible.
It's inspiring, honestly, like, for someone to still be in, like, the depths of it, to be this open and to put yourself out there is really inspiring. So thank you.
Yeah, look, there's no problem. And I suppose when I was asked, because through all this, I've ended up seeing a counsellor on my own, just because as much as we like to think we can carry all the shopping from the car in one go, there's just too many bags to handle sometimes. You need a bit of help. Yeah, I was asked why I wanted to do the podcast. And I remember just thinking that if just one person hears this and recognizes anything that I've said in terms of like auto waking or complete personality shift. Like I went from being happy-go-lucky to barely being able to get out of bed and having just this constant mask of I'm okay on me. So like if anyone hears that and recognizes any of it and they go and get sorted and it takes them on their own journey, well, then it's 100% worth it. Even though I'm not where some other lads in the group are, I was fortunate in the way of that myself and my wife weren't trying. And I found out before we did, because I can't imagine the heartache of trying and having complete body blow after body blow after body blow of every month not getting pregnant or miscarriages or anything like that. Because I managed to figure all this out before I had any of that, and it nearly destroyed me. It nearly ended me. So I'm very fortunate in the way that I found out. And if I can save one person the time and the heartache that I would have eventually went through had I have had all those failed attempts, then it's 100% worth it.
We appreciate it so much. We're finishing on a different final question this series.
Yeah.
So the final question is, if you could talk to your younger self, what would you tell him or what would you want him to know?
There's a couple of answers for this, I suppose, isn't there? You'd probably tell him to invest in Bitcoin or Facebook or something like that. But no, in all seriousness, if I could sit down with 18-year-old me, I'd just tell him that it is genuinely, wholeheartedly just okay to not be okay all the time. It's in no way makes you lesser of anything, less a man, less anything, to talk to someone. Because I was full of piss and vinegar when I was 18 and 19 and thought I knew it all, but today you can sit me down then. That's the one thing I tell her. Just, it's okay to not be okay and it's okay to talk.
Oh yeah, it's crucial advice. And you mentioned like, it doesn't make you any less of a man. It makes you more of a man to be able to open up and potentially put yourself in a vulnerable spot. That's true strength.
Don't invest in Bitcoin.
Also good advice.
Yeah, definitely good advice, buddy. Thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate everything that you're doing in the community. Appreciate you coming on here. Keep going, buddy. Doing an amazing job.
Thanks for coming on, mate. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favor and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to talk about in the mailbag, please drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message that comes through. And if you'd like a bit more guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by men who get it. For the latest updates, follow us on social media at Male Fertility Podcast. Remember, you're not alone.